Welcome to a Wonder Junkie podcast. I'm your host, Ryan Anderson. This is episode number one, and for the first episode, I interviewed a gentleman by the name of Robert Forte. Robert is a very special guest, and I'm glad to have him on. I feel pretty honored to talk to a guy like him on the first episode because he has been around the psychedelic renaissance field for probably about 40 years or so, and he's been around some of the key players in the field that played a huge role in this psychedelic renaissance. He was very close to Timothy Leary, and he was close to Albert Hoffman, Stanislav Grof, who I've learned from Breathwork and read many of his books. He knew Sasha Shulgin. He knew many of the key figures, Frank Baran, Ralph Metzner, Houston Smith, and the list goes on. And this is a very controversial conversation, especially when you compare it to the mainstream narrative that you hear when it comes to psychedelics. And this is a subject that I'm pretty close to and have had a lot of insight to for the last 15 years, just because I think these tools can be helpful and they've helped me over the years. I was lucky to find ways to use plant medicines, entheogens to benefit my life, but I've also seen the darker side. And over the years, I've actually come across information and different perspectives about the shadow side of the psychedelic renaissance and some of the weirder stuff that happened in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s with the MKUltra programs being developed by the CIA. And a lot of people just want to write that off as conspiracy and not look into it, but it did happen. And it's not like those programs dissolve and go away. They actually can become more sophisticated and decentralized. So I think it's important to pay attention to these elements of the psychedelic component, because this is some stuff that changes consciousness. And when you look at the big organizations like MAPS and some of the others that are pushing the medical model, I used to glorify it myself, and I used to look at all of it as positive, and I was excited about it. But once you start to see the investors and some of the commodification and commercialization and actually weaponization of these substances to shape consciousness and look at the social engineering components of it, it can get a little bit more sticky and more interesting and more weird. So I really wanted to have Robert on because when I encountered his work a couple of years ago, he was able to articulate it from a vantage point that not a lot of people can do because he was in it. He got to see it happen and unfold, and he's an elder in the community. And I think that's the most important part right now, is to start looking at our history and to start getting a deeper perspective, because we're going to see a lot of problems in this psychedelic renaissance, especially with the ketamine clinics and all of the medicalization of it. It's going to get conflicting, and you're going to start to see a fallout of it. And there's going to be more and more people coming forth with negative stories and ways that psychedelics ruin their lives. And I can see that happening already. So this is a very interesting and important subject to me. And Robert is a fascinating character. If you don't agree with him, try to open your ears and just listen to a different perspective. That's the whole point. I'm going to have many guests on the show that have conflicting opinions and that don't think like me. And I think that's the whole point. And that's how we learn. And that's how we expand consciousness. Robert is going to say some things here that probably will trigger some of you. And that's great. I think that when you feel offended or you feel stimulated in an emotional way, that means there's probably something there to look at within yourself or within the subject that he's speaking about. He comes from a pretty good place. I think he really, truly cares about these tools. He wrote a book called Entheogens and the Future of Religion. Fantastic book. And that actually helped Brian Mirarescu's work for his book, The Immortality Key. And he also played a key role in Timothy Leary's life. I read his book that he wrote, The Outside Looking In. He has an amazing website called alteredstatesofamerica.net. And on that website, you can go into his archives and read a lot of really cool stuff. interviews with Jack Kornfield and Gordon Wasson. So this is going to be a fun interview. We only do 2 hours, but you could sit with Robert for days because there's so much to unpack here. This is a very deep and intricate subject that would require almost a lecture course series. So hang on for the ride. I hope you enjoy the podcast and make sure you subscribe to the show. And I'm going to look forward to having many more guests. This is episode number one with Robert Forte. Here we are. Thank you, Robert. I've been looking forward to this for a while, connecting with you. You're a special person from a field of interest that I've been learning about for the last 15 years. So I've been looking forward to this for a long time.
Thank you. I really appreciate you reaching out and drawing me out and encouraging me to say some of the things that I've been kind of leaking out through Facebook and a little bit of Substack. And it feels, you know, time that we had this conversation. So here we are.
Absolutely. We are 9 hours apart. You're in Greece. I'm in Arizona. So we do have a little bit of a delay, I noticed, right when we started this conversation. But we'll try to edit that out, not worry about it. We'll just move forward if there's any choppiness to it. At least we're grateful that we can talk to each other from across the world. So that's pretty cool.
You know, from my end, when you speak, your lips are synced up perfectly with what I'm hearing. So I don't get to delay it. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. Well, we'll just roll with it. I've encountered your work a couple of years ago. My good friend Emil turned me on to your work. I remember he said, "Have you heard of Robert Forte?" I said, "No, I actually haven't." It led me to then listening to your conversation with Ryan Sprague. I think that's how you pronounce his last name. And that was a fun conversation. I actually listened to it 2 times in a row on a drive out to California. And I got to my destination and I immediately wrote you a message. And then I spent about 6 hours on your website, alteredstatesofamerica.net, for those folks. I'll put this all in the show notes. And I found myself reading for about 6 or 7 hours and just going down the rabbit hole and digging into what you've put online so far. And it was amazing. It seems like you've hung out with and worked with closely and been friends with a lot of the key figures in the psychedelic renaissance. A lot of folks that I really respect, Sasha Shulgin, Albert Hoffman, you were in Gordon Wasson's archives. It's amazing. So you've been close to a lot of the cool people that I've been exploring for the last 15 years. So I'm excited about this.
Yeah, I've taken a really deep dive into the phenomena of sacred plants and psychedelics and religion and modern psychology. Not only a deep dive, but a broad dive. And, you know, it was a calling. The substances called me. Really, they called me from the time I was just a young boy in the mid-60s, in 1967. I saw a magazine cover with LSD on it and was immediately, wow, what's that? I didn't get into taking them. I thought they made people strange. I was an athlete. I smoked herb, but I wasn't going to take drugs. It wasn't until my third year of college when I became very curious about the history of religion because I had learned to meditate. It's probably funny that it was the game of golf, which is, you know, one of the most prosaic. We don't usually associate golf with mysticism or psychedelic drugs, but really it was the game of golf that led me into my career because I was a very avid golfer, a very excellent golfer. My brother suggested that I take up meditation as a way to improve my concentration in golf. So I did. And it had a major impact on my life in every way. I became a better student. I could concentrate. I could read for a long period of time. I really matured. I learned a lot about the mind. And I became very curious, how did primitive people come up with something so simple and profound as meditation? And so I became interested in the history of religion, and I took a course. I was a student at that time at Columbia University in New York City, and the first day of this class on the history of Indian Buddhism, the teacher mentions the Rig Veda, the oldest body of writings in Indian religion, were these about these ceremonies that ancient, well, not ancient, but like 1500 BC, somewhere in there. They would go out and look for this plant that they would turn into a drink that gave them mystical experiences and informed them about the nature of the universe and the mind and mankind's role in. And this, the professor went over, never forget this, went to the board and wrote down, and the best theory for what soma was has been introduced by a Wall Street banker named R. Gordon Wasson. And he see, I can still see him when he writes his name on the board, and I'm sitting there. A Wall Street, a psychedelic mushroom? All these years, I thought they were just sort of reckless and, you know, not very significant. And here he's telling me that that was responsible for the beginning of these techniques and psychotechnologies. And it was a Wall Street banker, and all those disparate things sort of came together. And I just, like, a light went off and really felt like a calling, like, I got to know about this. So I left the class and went down to Broadway, where there's a bookstore, the Strand Bookstore. And I found some books, you know, Timothy Leary, Alan Watts, and I just bought a few books, and I became just really thirsty reader and just devoured everything I could in, you know, nearby. And then I moved to California to finish my degree. And I was just, again, like, took a class in psychological research methodology. And it turns out that my professor was a man named Frank Baron, who was the person really in many ways responsible for introducing psychedelics into modern society. You don't hear about him very much, but he was the guy who turned on Timothy Leary, and he started that Harvard project. And he was my professor, who became very close, and he encouraged, he said, you should, you know, it's been years since there's been any serious academic work on this subject, and you've got this background in meditation and altered states, and I think this is a thing for you. It's a little risky. And that's how I got started. It was a calling, and it was, you know, just what? So that was 1978 that I first heard Wasson's name. By 1984, 5 years later, I'm sitting in Wasson's living room, having lunch with him, about to drive him up to Cambridge, to Harvard University, where I had organized. And so all these meetings and deep relationships with some of the, you know, the people you mentioned, Frank Baron, Stanislav Grof, Timothy Leary, Alexander Shulgin, Albert Hofmann. Albert Hofmann treated me like his grandson for many years. You know, I published his last writings, got very close with him. So I'm just saying this because I don't know anybody that has the kind of background and relationships to the whole of this field. And to see this field unfold from the late 1970s and early 80s, when it was really like the dark ages. Research had been stopped in 1970. It wasn't in the media, it wasn't in the culture. They like disappeared. And then, you know, in certain significant ways, because of stuff that I did, I organized conferences, I started contacting people, bringing people together, get conversations going. This renaissance that Michael Pollan says started in like 2006. No. The thing was going long before that. And I was an important factor in it. And, you know, there's a lot more to this subject than most people are aware of. And I'm feeling lately that it's kind of a duty of mine to speak out about some of the other things. So thanks for giving me the opportunity.
I appreciate it. And that's actually why I feel so excited to talk to you. And when I encountered your messages and the way that you speak, it's very contradictory to the mainstream narrative, the mainstream newer narrative of the psychedelic renaissance and your perspective on the post-World War II era and the development of the CIA, that's something that I started to discover maybe 10 years ago. And I want to say I know that you deeply respect these things and that there's a deep, the reason that you're so passionate about it is because you care. And yeah. I think I feel the same way. And I think that that's where your message actually comes from. And I think if people can just lend their ear to a different narrative, even if they don't agree with it, or even if it triggers them or stimulates an emotional response, because it's a deep and interesting mystery. And I've been curious about this whole MK Ultra thing once I discovered it. And I remember getting into a conversation with a really brilliant, beautiful man that I got to live with for 6 months named Don Howard. And he started to bring it up a little bit. And, you know, he was someone that I respected too. He cared a lot and he used these things as sacred plants and he worked from his heart space. And when I started to see the psychedelic renaissance boom, I went to four MAPS conferences. I even volunteered for one of them. And I thought Rick Doblins was a hero. And, you know, he's a good, you know, he's a human being on the planet. I want to respect everybody's journey and realize that if I was in their shoes, I'd be doing the same thing. So I try to honor and respect people's situation. But I've started to realize that the investors and the people that these big organizations are tied to have a lot of problems. And there's a lot of issues with the commodification, the commercialization, and the weaponization of these beautiful tools that could be used for transformation. And I do respect them as well. And I think that's why we're here. We care and we want to get to the truth. And I think that a lot of people are resistant to having your message heard. I even wrote Zach Leary a message and said, you know, you need to get Robert on. And he said, oh, he's too far down the conspiracy hole. And even that word, which was created by the CIA, I get called a conspiracy theorist all the time. And I'm just a person that likes to seek to understand more about the nature of reality. I like to explore consciousness. I like to meet interesting people. And I like to learn. I'm curious. And I think once you let go of your ideological predispositions, you allow more information in. And I actually think ideology is a parasite on the mind. And I'm doing my best. And I think that's what these tools were created for, is to help you open up and receive if you're willing to. So anyway, I don't want to rant. I want to keep letting you speak. But that's where I'm coming from, brother.
Yeah, man. Well, you said so much there. And let me just, first of all, thank you for mentioning the fact that we share a very deep respect and love and appreciation for psychedelic drugs. That's really important because, when I began to speak out, share my critical view of what's happening, that gets lost, and that I'm saying what I'm saying. I want to say it all. I want to tell the whole story. You know, the situation that we're in with psychedelic drugs is not unique in history. There are many subjects. Let's just name a few. Religion in general. Look, the history of religion is a very big subject, and it includes everything about humanity, the very best of human beings, the highest aspirations, the most important fundamental things that guide our life, things like enlightenment and ethical systems and yoga and purification and inspiration and insight into metaphysical supernatural reality, the most important stuff. The history of religion also contains some of the very worst things about human beings. The use of superstition and mind control to manipulate populations as an excuse for grabbing territory, for genocide. Religion is both. So if you want to really be intelligent about the history of religion, you have to look at it broadly. It's not just Jesus saying, love your neighbor. It's a very big and complicated subject, and one of the most important ones. Sexuality. Sexuality is one of the, who doesn't love lovemaking with their chosen partner. You know, it's one of the most beautiful sacred experiences in our lives. One of my great teachers in the history of religion, Mircea Eliade, who started the discipline history of religions, would say that sexuality was the last vestige of the sacred in the modern world, that sort of power that it has for us is unmatched in the modern world. But sexuality also contains the very worst. There's rape, there's child trafficking, there's the sex industry. So when I issue some of these criticisms and observations from direct experience about the shadow side of psychedelic drugs, I'm not saying they're bad any more than if I'm critical of child sex trafficking, do I not make love with my wife? You know, it's like that. And then, you know, you mentioned Zach Leary. Now, I love Zach Leary. I've known Zach since he was 5 years old. You know, I was
so
close.
Highly of you.
Yeah, we're like, you know, I'm like Uncle Bob. I lived at the house. I was on the team that helped Tim die. Zach and I really love each other. But Tim was like this too, you know, toward the end of his life. And I was, you know, curious about CIA stuff, and he didn't really want to get into it. Most of what I learned about this MKUltra business came after my after Tim died. And I'd love to, Zach and I haven't seen each other for many years. Sometimes someone will say, like you said, you know, we speak highly of each other. We love each other. We're like family in a way. But this aversion that he has to conspiracy, and you said it very well, he sort of gets that from his father. And also because, you know, a lot of people don't want to dwell on that darkness. It's much more fun to look at all the bright stuff. But, you know, that's not my intellectual disposition. I believe in being thorough. And that's what we're doing here. So remind when we're done, I want Zach's phone number because I haven't been in touch with him for a long time. And
I actually don't have it. I think I was messaging him on one of the platforms, but I think too, a lot of the times people are afraid to get into this stuff because they want to not create controversy, or maybe they're politically tied, or there's so many different reasons why people are incentivized to behave certain ways. And, you know, I understand that and I respect that. I just want to talk to interesting people, take in different perspectives, allow them to be heard, you know, and I think that's what I appreciate most, especially in this time where we have so many people that are trying to, just glorify and create these ideas that, you know, ketamine's the next panacea. And it's like, no, let's look at the dark side of ketamine. You and I both read that book, Drugism, and it's like little things like that that allow you to hear the perspectives of the deeper issues. And then you start to see this psychedelic renaissance, the newer one, it's going downhill, and there's going to be a lot of backlash, and there's going to be a lot of problems, and people are going to start looking for, like, how did we get here? And I think that's where they can actually find your work very useful, you and many others that are at least trying to, from a good place, warn people, because you care. You don't want to see people harm themselves or be manipulated, you know, and that's what matters, is like, how do we preserve these tools, still have cognitive liberty, and still have an understanding of like the context? Because if we don't know history, we're just lost, you know?
Right.
It's like the species with amnesia. And I've even heard people like Graham Hancock, who I respect and have met, talk about all politicians need to do psychedelics. It's like, no, that would just amplify them and make them more psychopathic. And I disagree with him. And I would be willing to push back on that. And I think I would love to have a conversation with Graham because he's a smart guy. And I think he, you know, we'll get into all this stuff. But I just feel like we need to at least have the hard conversations. And I know you're willing to do that.
Absolutely. You know, again, we could go off on so many different threads that
and we
you
will.
Initiated. I was feeling like, let's see, pick one. Well, Rick Doblin. Let me tell a little story about Rick. this might sound strange to This might sound strange, but I'm just going to tell it as it is. In the early 1980s, when I was first starting to get into this, I had a very strong psilocybin trip. I took like 5 grams of mushrooms. I think it was 1983. And very powerful trip. The first time that I heard voices, you know, people that are familiar with psilocybin and know the history of psilocybin will know that this is part of it. There are these auditory phenomena. I didn't actually know that much about that. Suddenly, I am hearing voices in my head. And the voices are telling me that I've been selected, that I'm going to be part of an effort, a gathering of people to reintroduce psychedelic drugs into society in the form of a mystery school, to revitalize religion, to help expand consciousness, to help enlighten society. There were many political and ecological, religious, spiritual problems facing humanity, and there was going to be this wave of psychedelics, and that I was going to be part of it. The mushrooms were telling me things about my personality, that I was articulate, and I could communicate well, and I could meet people. And it said that there people were going to be coming into my life that were going to be part of this. I'm just completely dazzled by this stuff in my head. And also said, the voice also said that there would also be people that would be coming that would want to use psychedelics for a different agenda. There was going to be a light-bearing team, but there were also bad guys. And I, again, I'm just kind of floored by this whole experience. The next day it ends. I'm a psychology student, you know, and I immediately, and I'd already spent time living with Stan Grof at Esalen. I'd studied psychoanalysis. And my first response to this trip, my first interpretation of this trip was that, well, this is, you're just unconscious. You know, you're a graduate student. You want to do something important in your life. So you're unconscious, you know, it's like a dream and it amplifies, you know, you kind of grandiose vision of who you can be. This is not uncommon. And I don't think much more of it. Shortly after this, I got a phone call from out of the blue. I'm at this point in Chicago. I'm a graduate student in the history and psychology of religion at the Divinity School, the University of Chicago. And I got a phone call from a guy who says, hey, you know, I have a friend at Esalen, and he told me you were here in Chicago and you were studying psychedelics and history of religion. And I just think, you know, we could, I'd like to meet you. He says, you're really interesting. Come on up and meet me. I was like, okay. So I go up to the north side of Chicago and I meet this man. Well, this man, his name was Stuart Abelson, is a very unusual character. He was in his mid-40s at the time. I'm like, what am I, my mid or late 20s. And he was having a midlife crisis. His midlife crisis was that his father had died recently and left him the family business, which was the largest bourbon and whiskey distillery in the country. And he had like, he inherited like a fortune. He said it was a moderate fortune, but it was like in the hundreds of millions dollar kind of fortune. There are buildings in Chicago named after him. His father, you know, built the whole University of Chicago Performing Arts Center, like real serious money, right? And Stuart was went to Harvard in the early 60s, and then he went to Harvard Law School. He was totally, really interested in psychedelic drugs. When Leary was there, wanted to get involved in the Leary Project. But, you know, the Leary Project was really just a couple years there, and it ended as soon as it started. And Stuart had this unrequited love and interest and passion in psychedelic drugs. And here he is, we're talking. And he said, I just don't, you know, I don't know what to do with myself. And I said, well, you know, you got a law degree. You're brilliant. You know how important psychedelic drugs are. Like, why don't you, I said, what do you want to do? He said, well, I really would like to create a psychedelic research center. And I said, well, dude, you're the perfect guy. Do it. And I'm starting to think about my mushroom trip. Like, oh, wait a minute. This is what the mushroom said. And Stuart says, I'm really kind of shy and I don't want to do anything risky. I don't want to lose my money. I don't want to be involved in anything controversial. And then he said, I'll tell you what, he said, you do it and I will back you. I'm like, what the fuck? I went home and I called Stan Groff. And I said, Stan, you know, I had this mushroom trip and then this guy calls me up and it's like what the mushrooms predicted. Like, what? And Stan said, okay, let's do this. You know, Stan like, okay, let's organize a committee. Let's keep it totally secret. We don't want to draw any, like, it was a quiet time. We didn't want all that sensational stuff of the 60s, and it was going to be a secret sort of mystery school approach. And so I quit graduate school and started to devote my time to doing this. And just like the mushroom said, I would like have these meetings with people. And I could tell that there was something was starting to brew. I had met Sasha Shulgin already. Sasha Shulgin had liked me and taught me and my friends how to make MDMA. I had an MDMA laboratory where we were providing totally pharmaceutically pure MDMA made in a state-of-the-art lab at the University of California to therapists. I wasn't doing it for money. I don't need money. It was all because it was like a spiritual gathering, a mystery school was starting to create this underground movement and people starting to work, and it was magical. And then my partner at the time, I was doing a project with MDMA. It was an underground project. I would provide it to people. It wasn't illegal. And we wanted to come up with a cartography of what it did. And my project was simply giving it to people and asking them to write down what it did for them. I gave them very little instruction. Candlelight and people you love and trust. Let me know what happens. Don't tell anybody about this. Secret. It was a really fun period of my life. And I was able to turn on hundreds of people. You know, can you imagine? I had this little bag of magic dust and people loved it. There was no fixed ideas. Hardly anyone had ever heard of it. The experiences of the heart opening, connections with people, fantastic breakthrough healing with whatever, trauma, relationships, addiction. And I was starting to gather a whole stack of these reports. And then a friend of mine, my partner, meets Rick Doblin and volunteers to be one of the subjects in our study. She gives him MDMA. So of all the hundreds of people that were given MDMA in this quasi-formal study, Rick Doblin not only did not keep the secret, he calls the media. He calls Reagan. Ronald Reagan was president. Reagan's drug czar snitches out the project, says that there's this new, not illegal love drug people are using in Northern California, and kind of appoints himself the ambassador of this thing. He came to meet me in Chicago and it reminded me of the mushroom trip. And I knew the moment I looked at him that this was what the mushrooms were warning me about. This was someone who had a totally different agenda, that these drugs could be exploited. And Rick was going to be the guy. And I knew it at the time. And I just kind of watched this and just, you know, and now, you know, I look at this thing now 40 years later and I see what has happened, who he works for, what his agenda is, how he's tricked so many people. And, you know, he's a very likable fellow, but he's, I don't know if you saw that article that came out the other day, you know, like using, so,
The military.
Yeah, I'm kind of rambling. I'm kind of rambling here a little bit, but this is the point I want to make. And this is the book that I'm writing. There's one family of drugs. Let's just call them the sacred drugs. Drugs with these incredible possibilities. You know, the psychedelic drugs. And then we can include MDMA in there. We can include ketamine in there, even though they're not the same, but they have these psychedelic effects. One group of drugs. But there are totally different groups of people that use them for sometimes opposite reasons. You know, like the CIA was one of the main institutions responsible for introducing psychedelic drugs into modern society. And their agenda was to control consciousness. Not control it. I mean, control it by distracting it, control the population. Other people use Timothy Leary's agenda using psychedelic drugs was really to transform society. Some Ram Dass, Richard Alpert, his partner for just a short time, he just wanted people to love each other. He didn't want to change the world. So anyway, we need to like articulate this a little bit better, but this is a point I'm making. Well, since you mentioned Rick, I have a whole thing about that. Like, you know, he's all the media attention he gets as if he's some sort of hero. But if you look critically at what has happened in his career, it's really not a psychedelic vision that that psychedelics are really known for. He's a profiteer.
Yeah, and I'd like to start to, and we'll do this, I'm sure, we could sit for hours. I think you need like a docuseries or some sort of lecture series with a lot of prerequisites to get to where we're going to go. Even your interview when I hooked you up with my friend Kyle Kingsbury, you only had an hour together, but you laid out a lot of the scaffolding of what could be dove into on each segment as chapters. So someday maybe I'll come out to Greece and we'll sit down and we'll go into a series where we could dive deep into all these layers, because there is layers and a lot of people aren't going to have the time or interest to do so, to go into this stuff. And I respect that. I work with a lot of beautiful people that are family men and they're raising kids and they're building houses and they're first responders or, you know, they're amazing people. Why would they have time to read about the underbelly of social engineering? And I don't expect them to. I think everybody should do what they're here to do. And we all have our own gift and opportunity through our own experience to go after our own curiosity and our own wonder and sort of amplify ourselves to the degree that seems to be most useful. And for whatever reason, when I found myself reading your work at a coffee shop for 7 hours, I went, man, who the fuck else is reading this stuff? And who cares?
Yeah.
I gave myself permission to, because that's what I do. And that's who I'm in. That's what I'm into. And other people are golfing and other people are building businesses. And, you know, once we give ourselves permission to just go forth and to be curious and be passionate about what we're interested in, we find ourselves in different dimensions. And here we are talking to each other from halfway across the world. And I've always wanted to extract from you the most relevant story that you have, because you've been in these circles. You've been reading and circling around the people that I've been interested in for so many years. So let's dig into a little bit of, maybe we go back if you want to. First of all, I'm curious, at some point we need to hit on, did you ever think that you were being groomed by the CIA? But before we get to that, and not groomed, but just being, you know, you realize Tim realized he was being used by the CIA at one point. We're going to get into that. But I want to go back to the formation of the CIA, Alan Dulles. Let's dig into him and let's dig into that post-World War II area. And let's start getting into some of that and then start to see where it goes from there. Because that's the stuff that gets so fascinating to me, if you're into that.
Yeah. You know, so those are kind of two different ones. The first question, did I ever wonder if I was being groomed? And the answer is yes. Frank Barron was one of the prime instigators of my career.
Frank, the Department of Social Relations and that whole, at Harvard, when they started to develop these programs, what was the other one called? Personality Research at Berkeley. That whole thing was developed by the CIA. Is that correct?
Yep, it was. And Frank was one of the key members. You know, I mean, Frank died in 2002, right around the time that I was, I'd gotten a small grant and I was going to make a documentary film about Wasson. And I was in the Wasson archives at Harvard, and I found out some things about Wasson that were very shocking. And normally when I found out something shocking, I would immediately go to Frank and say, but look at this. But Frank had died. Now, Frank, so there's the personal part of it. And yes, that's possible that Frank was still a secret agent. Also, we have to say this, that the CIA is not one thing. CIA is, as Hunter Thompson once put it, you know, there are many rooms in that mansion. And Tim Leary would say the same thing to me around the same time that, you know, Robert, you have to understand that the CIA is not all bad. Bobby Kennedy, makes sense, says this now, too, that the CIA is a big organization. There are some very dark Third Reich-related, you know, totally fascist aspects of the CIA that do the very worst things in the world, from, you know, assassination of John Kennedy, 9/11, and things like this. For people that have drilled into these subjects, they know. but there's also a humanistic part of the CIA that recognizes that it's important to use intelligence and secrecy to help the world along. And I want to believe that Frank Barron was one of them. One of the things that Frank pointed out to me was that, you know, we have the OSS, which is the intelligence apparatus of the Allies in World War II, but there was overlap. When World War II ended, the OSS disbanded, and it disbanded into three separate entities, one being the Department of Social Relations at Harvard, the next being the CIA in Washington, and then the Institute of Personality Research and Assessment at Berkeley, which is where Timothy Leary and Frank Barron did their PhDs. And that whole post-war period is very hard to understand without considerable effort and a broad analysis of what happened. The whole official story of World War II and who Hitler was and who was behind Hitler is confusing. And so there are real prerequisites to getting what I'm saying. You know, if I just say something outrageous like, you know, World War II didn't really end, the Nazis were not really defeated, but that the global fascist movement came over to the United States in the form of the CIA and continued their quest for world domination in another form. Another form of warfare began to take place, and it was a psychological warfare. And and Alan Dulles was one of the chief characters in all this. And and a lot of Americans were swept up in the CIA in the early days because there was such a sense of pride in America for having defeated the Nazis. And there was like the United States government was, you know, unassailable, was such an honor to go work for the CIA. So a lot of these psychologists, Timothy Leary and Frank Barron, who took money from the CIA, were first very proud that they were selected by the CIA. And then as the CIA became more totalitarian and creepy, it's my understanding that Tim and Frank realized that this was completely against their deepest values and either refused to work for them or, in the case of Tim, tried to work against them. So
that's fascinating.
Alan Dulles is a very dark character in American history. I don't know if you saw this recent book by Ben Breen called Tripping on Utopia, mentions a little bit about the CIA's involvement and Alan Dulles. And, you know, we're really divided into two groups here, people that understand American history and somebody like Alan Dulles, who's been exposed in some great books, David Talbot's excellent book, what was it called? Not the Grand Chessboard, but his book about the Dulles brothers.
The Devil's Chessboard.
The Devil's Chessboard. Isn't that
something like that?
Yeah.
But The Beast Reawakens, I know that that was a book you mentioned that I would like to, I actually haven't delved into that. Martin Lee.
Yeah, that's a very important book. What happened to the Nazi intelligentsia at the end of World War II? Some of them went over to the Soviet Union. Some of them went to Israel. Mm-hmm. And some of them came to the United States. A few of them were executed after the Nuremberg trials, but not really. There were thousands of Nazis who were imported into the United States that took up positions. And NASA was formed by Wernher von Braun, right? Who, you know, he designed the missiles and rockets for the Nazi military. And then a few years later, he's setting up the NASA for the United States. Or, you know, people that really want to get into this and get specific, a guy, Reinhard Gehlen, chief of intelligence for Adolf Hitler, defects over here to the United States before the war and takes some of his proteges, like Henry Kissinger, and a guy named Theodore Shackley. And they set up the clandestine services division of the CIA. They go over, they start the Vietnam War. You know, like the American intelligence system, the American intelligence apparatus, the CIA, is very much formed by defected Third Reich Nazis.
And you could see during COVID, at least the beginning of COVID, at least a lot of the public started to see some issues in the last few years, at least the last 4 years. And even I think March 12th is when it hit me that we were inside of a World War III or something. There was some form of war happening. And I actually revisited Brave New World, revisited the book in March, because I could see that there was some form of socially engineered situation happening. It just felt in my core that something was going on. And I'm curious to go into your perspective on Brave New World, Aldous Huxley's perspective, and the correlation to the development of that MK Ultra program. Because when you get into that stuff, it just gets so much more interesting and so weird. I read Chaos. I'm sure you read that book, Thomas O'Neill. And then I've read a bunch of other books that just barely tip into that MK Ultra stuff. And I feel like your perspective on it sure goes deeper and it sure is interesting. And I'd love to hear what you think and hear you describe your correlation to Soma and how psychedelics are being used and other substances to just help people to feel good enough to get by and to instead of actually reckoning with depression and the feelings that they probably should be encountering, because we have a situation here where we would actually be then, you know, emotion creates response and reactivity. And if you're not feeling the emotions because you're microdosing or you're taking MDMA or whatever you're doing that you're blissing out, you're missing the point. You know, it's like, how do we integrate these experiences if you're going to use them? Maybe. So anyway, let's go into that, because I think that's where I find your work most fascinating.
Yeah. Well, as you said before, the information that I'm beginning to share is It's not a podcast. It's it's a graduate level course in the history of psychedelics. There are chapters. There are prerequisites. It's very rich material, and we have to be patient. And one of the things we would do if I was to teach a course on this, you would pick certain characters. So Dulles would be one. And let's really look at Alan Dulles and where his relationships were. What was he doing during the war? What's the media say about him? You know, there's a whole study there, Alan Dulles. Well, Aldous Huxley is another one. Fascinating, fascinating character, you know, kind of required reading for Americans when you're, you know, in high school. Brave New World. So Aldous Huxley starts his literary career with some little writings, but Brave New World is his first big book. And you know, it's interesting. Brave New World was on a list of banned books, like one of the most banned books in American history. And Brave New World is a novel that Huxley publishes in 1938. It's a novel about a society in the future, 600 years in the future, where all the wealth and power is controlled by a very small number of people at the top of this pyramid. And they live in big houses and they have all the freedom and power and of the wealthy. And then, but all these people down here are kind of like, they're either stupid, they've been like genetically manipulated and they're just dumb and they can't do anything but, you know, I forget the names Huxley uses for them, but they're they live in small houses and they're just like the slaves of the oligarchs. And the thing about Brave New World is that nobody organizes themselves politically to do anything about their situation, even though they're the vast majority of people. And one of the main reasons that they don't do anything about their predicament is that when they start getting a little aggravated about their situation, they are ordered to go on what they call a soma holiday. And a soma holiday is like Burning Man. You go away, you're given this drug that's called soma. And soma is like, this was 1938, so psychedelic drugs were not very well known, but it's like a psychedelic drug. It's like a quasi-psychedelic drug that gives you an experience that everything is okay. It's like MDMA. Everything is okay.
Or on the TikTok soma holiday, you know.
Yeah, it's a drug that makes you feel like everything is okay, and you're also supposed to fuck your brains out on these soma holidays, and then you go back to your normal life at the end of the weekend after you've just had this whole. Now, who wants to start a revolution? Who wants to go through the hard work it takes to educate people and register voters and do all that hard stuff, face all these difficult things, if you know that on the weekend you can just take this thing and you're going to be fine? That's the gist of the novel. So 20 years later, Aldous Huxley writes an addendum to Brave New World, little 20 or 30 page essay, a nonfiction essay, where he says, you know, I pictured Brave New World in the future 600 years, but it's already happening now. And the soma, here's all the ways that the world controllers, he calls them, control society through the media, through entertainment, and then he's a chapter on what he calls chemical persuasion. And he says very clearly in here that LSD is the new soma. Here are these drugs, and this is what's happening. And nobody's going to change the course of society because they can have this immediate gratification and these faux experiences of enlightenment. And they're just going to be totally distracted from their political subjugation. And it's just clear as a bell. And, you know, everybody knows Brave New World, one of the most widely read novels in, you know, American, in the English language. And but hardly, comparatively few people know Brave New World Revisited, where they just sort of lay it out there. And anyway, that's a whole chapter when we really want to look at what's happening here. That's
and
one
I,
of the
clear- And I feel like Tristan Harris's work, The Social Dilemma, I'm not sure if you've come across it, and he has a podcast called Your Undivided Attention. He talks a lot about, instead of substances, the social engineers that want to control people in this way of soma, if you will, would use TikTok, and it's the attention economy. And you and I are a little bit older. I'm 42. I think you're in your 60s. So we lucked out not being born into this smartphone technology with these apps. But when you look at the way they engineer these apps, I'm actually more concerned not with the microdosing and the ketamine, which is all going to probably go off the rails to some degree, and we're going to see that. And hopefully it balances out and people can start to head into a healthier way to use these tools. But which maybe it's going to work out, maybe it's not. But TikTok, these young kids that are born into the Snapchat, TikTok screen addiction. And you look around and I see high schoolers and young kids, even people my niece's age, that are always exhausted and they're overweight and they're depressed. And there's an epidemic of mental health issues. And it's because of this attention economy. And there's an incentivization structure that's been built to drive profit, to capture people's attention and rape people's attention. And it's the most powerful weapon of mass distraction to send any message you want into these people's heads, which amplify digital narcissism. And all of the worst elements of human nature are being exploited here for profit. And it's unbelievable how many people are just tired and weak and depressed, and no one's doing anything about it. I think people are starting to recognize there's an issue, but a lot of times the older generation doesn't realize just how powerful it is, because we didn't grow up with it and we weren't immersed in it, and our frontal lobes were developed and we have that ability to be more disciplined and to pull back from it. But I've even seen like my parents addicted to Facebook and they're scrolling, and you know, I love them, but just like we saw the obesity epidemic, we're seeing this epidemic of mental health. And I really do think it's correlated to this TikTok. And I know that MKUltra doesn't just dissolve and go away. It gets more sophisticated and more decentralized and becomes more and more amplified at whatever level they want to use it. So I'm curious what your thoughts are on weapons of mass distraction as the soma of the times.
Yeah, let's just go back to Huxley for a second, because, you know, this key word here, attention. Huxley starts his, he becomes a major literary figure with Brave New World, and then writes several other books, gets more into religion, writes, of course, The Doors of Perception. But in the end, he writes, his last major work is Island. And Island starts with the word attention, and it ends with the word attention. And, you know, Tim Leary and Aldous Huxley's lives overlapped for just a year or so, year or two. And Tim was great at reducing complexity into memes. And one of Tim's memes was, "Who controls the eyes controls the brain." And so this is speaking to your point about TikTok and attention, and who can capture your attention has really got you. And, you know, it's really the essence of genuine psycho-spiritual transformation disciplines like Buddhism. It's all about who's got the reins on your attention. You should. Meditation is a exercise to control your attention. And what you have now in modern society is you've got a whole, you know, they've come up with this new phrase, attention deficit disorder, attention deficit hyperactivity. They made a, you know, oh, here's a drug you can take for it. Well, it's really the cardinal problem of existence, according to Buddhist psychology, is that our mind just wanders and, you know, we don't really get to see deeply enough into phenomena to know what it is. And we're just like dancing around from one thing to another. Well, now you've got a, you know, incredible epidemic of that, as you're saying, you know, that's really accelerated, amplified with these technologies like, you know, I mean, I never look at TikTok. I do notice me, because I'm an information addict. And before computers, I would read, you know, three newspapers a day. I would read books. I had a massive library. And now with my laptop, I have access to all the information in the world. And so, yeah, it's a tricky thing. I don't like flip around. I read, but we have to.
The institutions and like John Taylor Gatto's work, when he describes the institutions being created in a way that help people to become more obedient, more compliant, and it's all built on test scores. And if you look at the history of the education system in the West, all the way back to like the 1800s, one of the books he wrote was called Weapons of Mass Instruction. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, but I read that book.
I just know the name.
So eye-opening. Yeah, his work's amazing because it really just synthesizes a lot of the information about how the Western education model. And I mean, if you're in Japan or you're in China, they have their own institutions. And I'm sure that if you wanted to create a society in a way that you think would be most proficient, you're going to build the education models in that way. But ours is built on test taking and having information stored and being taught what to think, not how to think. And so people that, you know, don't have the answers, which is probably the best place to live, is in the unknown and to be in that curious state and to question authority, which is what Timothy O'Leary would say. And that's gone away. We've got a compliant, obedient culture, but it's because of the institution. So you look at, like, if you wanted to high level look at it and how MKUltra and all these social engineers created a system, and people don't want to get into this stuff because they're afraid to look at the truth and see what's beyond the veil. And that's actually the whole point of meditation. When I used to lay in the float tanks when I was 30 years old, the first thing I recognized was that I was a giant computing system, like John Lilly said, and that I was a biocomputer and I had all this old hardware, but I was being indoctrinated by my culture. And I saw my mind as something separate. I could see that I was a giant narrative creating, belief system creating machine. And I wanted to get to the root of it, which is why I used certain tools. And that's still why I use them once a year or so, very rarely, to look at with a distance who I am. And a lot of times it's uncomfortable. And a lot of times you have to dig into that stuff and go, holy shit, my whole life's a fraud. It's a sham. The whole thing's a sham. But then you have to integrate it and go, it's okay, though. You have foundational principles and truths, and there's moral foundations, and you can build your operating system the way you want and choose which friends you hang out with and which books you read and how you think, and just be very careful with your belief systems, which is so important. And people are afraid to do that, which is why we know who Taylor Swift is or whoever the main celebrity is, but we don't know who Klaus Schwab is or, you know, Soros or some of these big names that people should know. I actually post little pictures of Klaus Schwab and people at work go, who the fuck's that old guy? You know, but they know the name of every celebrity, or, and it's not their fault. I don't even blame them. And I don't blame people for, you know, the COVID situation. I think they've had high level, sophisticated psychological warfare put onto them at the highest level, especially with technology. And that's why I like Robert Malone's work and people like that. They can help you to have compassion for people so that we're not at war with each other and wondering why these people are idiots. Or it's like, no, they're just humans, but they have been indoctrinated to the highest degree. So God forbid you are nice to them and go to the principles of all those religions you talked about and show them respect and try to have real conversations with them from a more heart-centered space, which is what I'm trying to do. And, you know, that's all we can do. But when it comes to attention and all that stuff, it's like, let's look deep at the indoctrination system that's been in place for, what, the last couple hundred years, if not thousands. So anyway, I just wanted to throw that out there.
Yeah, again, you're saying so many important things. I just noticed in myself, I want to just take a deep breath and go slowly and like pull out what you're saying and make it really visible. And one of the things that's coming up is the research of Solomon Asch. Like there are different people, are not all the same. There are people who are obedient. They're like herd animals. And they gather their authority from outside of them. What's the institution say? What's the right thing? What's my church telling me? What are my parents telling me? What's the school telling me? For other people that are their locus of authority and control comes from within them, like you just described that realization when you were in the tank. Oh my God, I'm a computer. Like I'm all this information is coming in and I'm processing it and creating a reality. It's happening in here. So these difference in personalities and cognitive styles has been a main focus of the field of social psychology, which was kind of started by this man named Solomon Asch. And his research is actually very, very important in the genesis of one of the psychedelic movements. Again, there's the book that I'm writing is called Psychedelic Movements of the 20th and 21st Century. Because there's been a movement to control consciousness, and there's been a movement to liberate consciousness. These drugs are used to consolidate power for the oligarchs, the wealthy, or they're used, as Timothy Leary tried to use them, to democratize power. And this this traces back to this research of Solomon Asch. Do you know who Solomon Asch is? Should I just try to give a little summary?
I think you should give a summary, just so everybody listening can get into that.
So anybody that's taken a psychology course in college, you know, we're different generations, like you said. I'm 20 something years older than you, but when I was in college, everybody that took psychology learned about Solomon Asch. These were experiments that started in the late 1930s, where imagine you're in college and somebody comes up to you and says, we're doing a study in eyesight, and here we'll give you $5 or $20, whatever, if you want to just take part in this experiment. And you say, okay, sure. So you're led into a room and there's 19 other people in that room. You don't know it, but you think that all those people are like you that just been taken off the street to be part of this experiment. But actually, you're the only one being tested. And they're all confederates of the experiment. You're told it's an experiment on perception. The experimenter goes over to the blackboard and he draws three lines. Sorry, he draws four lines. Three lines over here and one line over here. And you're asked to say which one of these three lines is the same length as this one. And the answer is obvious. You know, one line is 12 inches long, one line is 6 inches long, one line is 8 inches long. It's obvious. It's unambiguous. You sit there, you're the 20th person. You listen. Everyone that goes before you gives the wrong answer. Now it's your turn. What do you do? So when I say this to people, what would you do? Almost everybody says, oh, I would give the right answer. But when Solomon Asch did this in an experiment that has been replicated hundreds of different ways, it's one of the most researched phenomena in social psychology. And Solomon Asch started it. He found that 75 or 80% of the population would defy their own senses and give the wrong answer in order to conform to the group. Now, think about that for a minute. You think about COVID, and you know, this is like during the height of Nazism, and That's a big problem, that you would defy your own senses in order to give the wrong answer to conform to the group. Only, 15 or 20% of the population would do that. They had so little, trust or confidence in their own self that they couldn't bear to. And it was Frank Baron who noticed this and was curious, what is it about those, that 10 to 15% that defied the group that gave the right answer? How do we make more of those kinds of people? How do we validate the internal locus of authority? And this, I'm just imagining, a podcast listening to this. This is, again, a subject that you really want to draw out in a course and have dialogue with people and really look into it. But this is a major part of this. In fact, Paul Check sent me a brief, I don't remember the name of the author, but on the psychology of compliance. And we have, as you mentioned before, when COVID happened, some people were like immediately, wait a minute, that's bullshit.
Yeah. Well, if you look at our species as a superorganism, which I like to do sometimes, I like to think of the idea that those experiments just reveal our consciousness at a grand scale and show that that evolutionary trait of compliance or hive-like mentality can be a good thing, which is how we have megalithic structures like the pyramids built, or how we have the infrastructure downtown. Like, we need plumbers, we need people to be busybodies that are, but if we have the right leadership and the right people in place with the right ideas, that would be obviously utopian vision. But yeah, when you have the right heart-centered space, like a place like Chavin, or there's places that existed for short periods of time, even on a small scale, if you look at within a group at the firehouse, I have 8 people that I work with closely, and I can trust them with my life and give them the keys to my car and my bank account. And it's amazing. And I have good leadership. But once you scale out and you get into the grander scale, compliance is no longer a good thing. And I don't even know that people are able to be anything other than their nature. It's like, I used to think, man, everyone needs to wake up. And it's like, well, maybe you are a certain way and they're a certain way, and that's good. And leaders emerge. But right now we just have a corrupt ecosystem. And so with the wrong leadership, you get the wrong outcome. But with the right leadership, it's an incredible superpower. So I just wanted to see what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah. Again, we're just kind of throwing paint on the wall here. This is these are very big conversations to have. You're right. That's why I said people are different. Like, animals are different. Some animals are herd animals. Some animals are, live in trees by themselves and are not herd animals. And we're like still figuring out how to organize the human race in a way that is fair and humanitarian. But what we're seeing now in the world is an increasing totalitarianism and an increasing concentration of wealth by a small, and they're not like Plato's idea of the philosopher kings. These are ruthless, pirating, greedy, power-hungry people that are operating our government at the highest level. And whether we're going to see a correction of this in anytime soon, it's a very exciting thing to watch.
Yeah, we're here for it. I mean, if we live even 10 more years, if we're lucky enough to be here for 10 years, which I would love to, I'm already grateful to be alive and awake and aware at all. That's always my first prayer, is like, thank you for letting me have awareness. But the sophistication and technological progress that's emerged that allows for that super authoritarian, and they understand the psychology at the highest degree and they can deploy it in certain ways that are far more powerful. But I also see the double-edged sword. The other side is conversations like this, where I'm in a freaking little mini spot in my house and I'm talking to a guy from Greece and we're sharing ideas, and maybe a couple thousand people listen, and maybe 5 of those people have the opportunity to create change. And, then there's a Joe Rogan who has 190 million downloads per episode, and he might get someone like you on who can have a conversation which sparks little fires in places and you don't know where the ripple goes. And that's actually what I wanted to do with you from the beginning. I wanted to just share your, you know, you and many others. There's a lady named Sanchi Retta who I'll be interviewing next week, and she's a Zen master, and she's Don Howard's sister, and she's going to be dead soon because she's in her late 70s. And I'm like, I just want to amplify and use these tools for good. It's like AI. We can use it for good or we can use it for bad. And they're here regardless. It's like a tidal wave coming in. So we build bigger ships and we learn how to sail these oceans. And that's what we've always done throughout all of history. There's been tyrants. There's been weirdos. There's been people in power. And then there's been good people that are always seeking good, you know. And I know people within my little frame of reference that are incredible people. And they inspire me to be a better version of myself, you know, and I want to be an inspiration to other people to the best of my ability. I'm not perfect, but it's like all we have to do is come alive. And, you know, you've heard that quote, don't ask what the world needs most, ask what makes you come alive, because what the world needs most is more people to come alive. And each individual has their own capacity to have influence. It could be raising kids. It could be just, you know, we all know that because you've studied some of the Eastern texts and it goes back to those core principles. And anyway, I think that the regardless of how complex this stuff gets, which I can't wait to get further into, I have hope still. And I think that's what matters. And a lot of the young kids, when you look at the depression and the way they're being labeled as victims and as traumatized, which we should get into, they've been indoctrinated to be identified as victims. And it is a cultural issue. It's not an individual issue. It's like, you shouldn't feel good if the culture's sick, you know? You should feel depressed when you look at your school system as a giant prison and that they're making you sit for 8 hours and trying to medicate you on Adderall because you can't pay attention. You know, so I think there's a real symptomatic component that we're trying to see. The therapists are trying to use talk therapy and medications and all this stuff and label you a victim, which I want to go back into with the Rick Doblin's MAPS movement and the whole psychoanalysis movement. It's like, dude, these kids need to have meaning and purpose. Viktor Frankl's message, you know, it's the logos therapy and things like that that actually hold strong through time. I know that if I was put in a hard situation, regardless of what it ends up being, I have a choice. And my choice is how I relate to my experience.
Yeah, you would definitely be one of the subjects in Ash's experiment who would listen to 19 people give the wrong answer, and you'd say, no, wait a minute. That's the answer right there. You know, you would be one of those people.
And die for it.
And die for it, yeah. So your psychedelic experience. See, the thing about psychedelics, back to that Ash model, I don't think psychedelic drugs change a person very much. Frank Baron became interested, as I said, in those people that did not conform, and interviewed them and did personality tests and found out that they just had, you know, an internal locus of control. They had a more optimistic view of human nature and nature. And he was wondering, like, how are we going to get more of those kinds of people? And so he was introduced to psychedelic drugs, to mushrooms in the late 1950s. And he thought, this is the thing. This is the thing that can show the individual that the wealth of creativity and mystery and power that's within us. And so he turned on Tim and began that project and started to, you know, kind of, but he realized that actually that's not what happens. Psychedelics don't really change the structure of the personality. They enhance what's already there. And so a person who has a creative orientation and an internal locus of power and control and understanding and trust in themselves, psychedelic drugs will make more of that. They'll make creative people more creative. But they'll make authoritarians more authoritarian as well. And, you know, again, I like to point out two of the main characters in the modern psychedelic movement. The first movement, Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert, became known as Ram Dass. That they were very different people. Tim was an anti-authoritarian. He was a creative thinker. He didn't go along with what was offered him. He didn't trust authorities. Ram Dass is totally the opposite. Ram Dass was an authoritarian. Oh, he's a nice guy, but that's an authoritarian personality. Like, where's first? It was the institution of Harvard, the psychiatrists, like always glorifying those. Then it became his guru until the end of his life. It was always his guru. And Tim was like, fuck all that shit. You know, it's like the individual. Drugs didn't change. Just changed the, you know, who the authority was. And so, you know, a guy like Doblin, you know, Rick never wanted to change anything about the world. He just wanted to, you know, he came from a very wealthy family and he didn't want to change anything. He wanted things just the way they are. And
I agree with a lot of this. I'm just real quick going to step in and ask you what you think about the healing components of these things in the right setting and the right context. Because I actually got lucky enough in my lifetime, not only for myself, but I've seen wonders be worked with plant medicines. Not always. Like you said, they can be non-specific amplifiers and they can be agents of amplification in ways that can be sort of neutral. But I've also seen nervous system resets with breath work, and I've seen people heal trauma that was spiraling them out of control. And I know you've worked close with Stan Grof, and I'm actually a breathwork facilitator, which I never thought I'd find myself sharing with others, but I almost feel obligated to, because I'm like, where would I send my mom, my dad, people at work to where it's not too woo-woo and where they're not being indoctrinated or infiltrated with too much stuff? I actually try to get out of the way and create just a container for people to have access to their own nervous systems and their own subconscious minds. And I feel like there is a lot of healing in there. And I know you do too, to some degree. So I'm curious if we can push back
Let me make this clear what I'm saying. Okay. So first of all, yes, the psychedelic drugs, MDMA, has marvelous and unique properties of dispelling resistance to understanding your psychopathology or your neurosis. But there's a difference between changing the personality and healing a trauma or gaining insight into yourself. So I have a feeling that's why you mentioned that, because I said psychedelic drugs don't change you. They don't really change the structure of the personality. They will help you gain insight into yourself and become, you know, heal like traumatic wounds or, you know, relationship counseling or drug addiction. But I think if you have an authoritarian personality, that's hard to change. That's not a pathology. That's just like, that's the kind of animal you are. You know, maybe there's astrological reasons why you're that way. You know, I look at,
yeah,
it's funny, I got turned on to this, the Chinese system of astrology by one of the more unusual characters in the psychedelic movement, Bear Owsley, who made a lot of the LSD, or allegedly made the LSD, and he turned me on to this system. And you know, the year that you were born and what animal archetype, that doesn't really change. And again, if you're a horse, my partner and I are into this. You know, I'm born the year of the monkey, and I have all these characters. You know, I'm not really like, I'm not that social, kind of like. But she loves to be with groups. She's a horse. Horses live in herds. They like live together. They do. That's how they are. There's nothing wrong with that. That's just who you are. Mm-hmm. And
cool. So, yeah, I just wanted to hear a little bit more on your perspective on that.
Oh yeah, no. I mean, I worked as a, you know, guiding people with psychedelics, different psychedelics, you know, off and on for many years. When I was doing my MDMA project, I would guide people, I would hold groups, and we would have fantastic breakthroughs. When I got into, I took a very deep dive into ayahuasca because, I was witness to a very dramatic healing of a very virulent form of melanoma that was going to kill this person I knew. And he drank ayahuasca for 2 months, completely cured his cancer. And there's, so again, those are different, like structure of personality. That's one thing. Healing potentials of psychedelic drugs are vast. It's one of the,
and there's so many good people inside of these organizations like MAPS. I've met them, and there's so many beautiful people that are bright eyed and they're looking at the glorification of it. And I can see why. And I've met so many beautiful people in the psychedelic integration space, even, that have good hearts and they actually want to do good work. And I think they are. And I know that you know that too.
Absolutely.
But I just like to remind people that there's good and then there's bad. And that's just how it's always been. And then when it comes to these substances or these hypnotic states, even breath work, it's such a powerful hypnotic state that you have to be careful who you're subjecting yourself to. You know, and that's what the MKUltra programs ended up discovering, it seems like, is, you know, that's how Manson and people were manipulated by these psychologists to be in hypnosis and to be, they were experimenting with mind control. And they've learned a lot since then, and now they're just deploying it in different, more sophisticated ways. So the real undertake is almost like, be careful, approach these things with caution. Who are you around? What are you listening to? What music? Are you in nature alone, or are you in a therapist's office who doesn't even have the qualifications, and you're wearing a eye mask, and you're, you know, it's like this stuff is, you're altering consciousness, and you're never going to be the same after you get done with these experiences. And, you know, you got to just approach it with care. And I'm conservative with my approach with these things. And I know you are now too, because I used to think everyone should do them. It's going to make everyone better. And then I met someone it was 2012. I went to Burning Man when my hair grew long, and I became somewhat of a radicalized person because I was under the influence of a lot of propaganda. And just the nature of the beast is that when you first have your experiences, you go, holy shit, if I'm feeling like this and it's making me feel good, why wouldn't everyone have these experiences? But it doesn't work that way. I met a guy who ripped another guy off for a couple million bucks, and he was a total sociopath. And he talked about ayahuasca and all these psychedelics, and he had his, you know, psychedelic passport, and people like to tell everyone about their resume of psychedelics, like they're so enlightened. And I started to see that in the so-called spiritual movement, whether it be yoga studios or festivals, and everyone's so proud of their psychedelic use. But at the end of the day, it's like, who are you and how are you behaving in culture? How are you integrating these experiences? Because I've met some bad people that made me question all of it. And that's where I found the MKUltra stuff and started to question my own thinking. And I think people should do that.
Absolutely. Again, you know, this is a course. It's a long, slow conversation, but you're hitting a lot of the, you know, subjects that I found really important. This notion of, there was an article in the New York Times yesterday or the day before, the psychedelic evangelist. I've been using that phrase for a while, you know, psychedelic evangelism. And, you know, when you find something that's wonderful, you know, you want to tell all your friends. There's like an incredible enthusiasm about it that overlooks a lot of the, a lot of things sometimes. And MAPS, you know, this is another thing that makes my criticism hard for some people to accept, because there are a lot of wonderful people that are drawn into MAPS. And, you know, I try to say, it's like the Catholic Church. There are a lot of wonderful people. My mother, you know, the Catholic Church does really great stuff. They, you know, love your neighbor. There's really good stuff. But if you really look at the history of the Catholic Church and what it was formed out of and what they actually do, there's a real dissonance between the fact that there are a lot of nice people that get swept up in it and what the overall, you know, movement of the institution is about. And, you know, beautiful. That's a, you know, so.
And the question authority and think for yourself thing got, you know, dismantled, like you hear Michael Pollan's new book, and you hear that newer version of the narrative being somewhat of a, you can tell it's somewhat of an orchestrated effort to give people this watered down, oversimplified version of the psychedelic history. And that's unfortunate, because the most important pieces are missing. And someone like yourself who's lived and worked with and been a part of this movement, you will get outcast. People are not going to want to hear it. But I think more and more people are going to start tuning into your message and at least starting to hear with more of an open ear, because they're starting to see problems. And you're going to see more and more problems. I don't know if you've met Jamie Wheel yet. I hope you do. I know you've heard of him through Kyle, because I sent him to Kyle a while back. But he was one of the only talks at the most recent MAPS conference that pushed back and talked about the negatives and the downfall of the new psychedelic movements. And he thinks it's going to hit rock bottom, I think, by 2027. And people are going to go, how the fuck did we get here? I love the way he speaks. I know there's things I disagree with him, and but he would be a good conversation for you to have.
I'd like to meet him. Yeah, no, I haven't met him yet. I listened to somebody interview him. I don't remember if it was Kyle or Aubrey Marcus, maybe. But I'd like to have some things with him.
Yeah.
But what you said back there about pollen and the narrative, you know, this is something that I take on, and I'm in my writing and in my speaking. And there's a story about psychedelic drugs, the modern history of psychedelic drugs, that Pollan's book is, you know, one of the best expressions of. But you'll see this narrative repeated in all the mainstream media, that, and the narrative goes like this, that Albert Hofmann discovers LSD in the early 1940s. Aldous Huxley writes The Doors of Perception. The psychedelic drugs were slowly becoming known into contemporary society through psychiatry, through literature, Huxley, through the arts like Cary Grant. And they were starting to be known for their scientific value in neuroscience and in psychotherapy. And then, Timothy Leary, he got a hold of them, and he made a mess. And so the government had to make these drugs illegal. And then 30 years went by, and this courageous group of hardworking people led by, you know, Rick Doblin, and people started doing this research, and now they're finally overcoming the, you know, recklessness of Timothy Leary. That Timothy Leary, we should blame him for fucking this whole thing up. That's the narrative. Almost every single time you see an article in the mainstream media about this new renaissance, that's what you'll see. I put a thing on my Facebook page the other day when they first started doing this. And that was what I believed when I first got into it. If you read in my first book, you know, the introduction to my first book, like, yeah, they were starting to become known. And then Tim kind of ruined it. Leary ruined it. Well, after I got into this more and more, I started to realize there's something else going on here. And that Tim ruined what the government, what the CIA was trying to do. Tim learned that he was being used by the CIA to popularize psychedelic drugs for a political agenda that he detested. He didn't want to be used by the CIA anymore. He didn't want a totalitarian society where everything was measured and controlled by a hidden elite. He wanted a democratic society. And so he dropped out of what the CIA was luring him into and started his own movement to question authority and think for yourself. That's exactly the, see, he was playing memes with it. It was exactly the opposite meme that before that, it was, no, trust your psychiatrist, trust your institution, trust your church, trust your guru, put your trust out there, weakens the individual. That's what they were trying to do. And then you look at this new wave of psychedelics, you know, post you know, since the one that Pollan is describing, oh yeah, psychedelics are fine if you use them with a government-approved therapist. Or the whole ayahuasca thing, like, well, you got to take ayahuasca with an ayahuascaro. Or it's not like this. It's not like nobody's legalizing drugs for people to use them themselves or to question authority. You never see anything about that. You never see anything in the new memes and media about psychedelics. Like, hey, you know, like our military budget is really too high. Or what about these wars? It's not about questioning authority. It's about trusting the authorities. Completely the opposite. That's a really important subject to really flush out more and more, I think.
Yeah, and can you give a little overview of your perspective on how that deployment with MKUltra was thought or used to sort of create, to go against the anti-war movement? Because I've heard you describe it a little bit and give a blanket, you know, overview of it, and maybe that's all we can get into here, but I am still having a hard time understanding the real nature of it, because there was a really well-organized anti-war movement already happening at the colleges, like you said. And to create this hippie movement, which is where the word was even created by the CIA and the hippie houses and all this stuff. But it's just a really curious subject, and I'd like to hear your perspective on that. And then we can get into maybe some of Eisenhower's speech in the military-industrial complex and John Kennedy getting assassinated and his underestimation of that machine. And that all ties into that crazy period of time where we started to lose control of democracy, I think. That was the infiltration like you were talking about.
Yeah, that Vietnam War era, a lot of people are given the impression that psychedelic drugs helped spark the anti-war movement. They didn't. They helped deteriorate the anti-war movement. And now again, it's a study, and it's a study that, you know, if I were leading the discussion, I would have us all watch this great movie called Berkeley in the 60s. The anti-war movement, as you just said, was well underway. There was a group called Students for a Democratic Society, SDS. These were bright kids from the best colleges, and they didn't like what was going on, and they started to, you know, take classes and organize voter drives, and an anti-war movement was starting. I'm talking about, like, you know, 62, 63 in there. And then they were becoming effective. And then all of a sudden there's this group in there called the Weathermen Underground. And they bring in LSD, and they bring in, you know, sexual liberation, and they become violent. They infiltrated SDS. And they turned the mainstream against the anti-war movement. The anti-war movement went from organizing voters to trying to levitate the Pentagon, you know, these fantastical psychedelic ideas. And that's not how you can't levitate the Pentagon. You got it. So that was, or another thing I like to point out, a lot of people have seen this. It's kind of funny, you know, there's a video on YouTube called LSD being tested on British troops, where you see it's a little grainy black and white film of, I still don't know if it's an actual exercise, but British troops are given LSD and they're conducting war games. You know, they're supposed to march in straight lines and read maps and conduct strategic operations. And they give them LSD. And, you know, as soon as the LSD takes effect, they can't do anything. You know, they're like looking at the map and turning it upside down, or they're hugging trees or laughing and rolling on the ground. And people look at that and say, oh, see how LSD is, you know, can help bring about a peaceful world because you can't fight a war if you're taking LSD. Well, no, you can't. You can't organize an anti-war movement either. You know, these are like destructuring agents. And the so I think that speaks, you know, a little bit to your question there. And this is, again, back to Huxley, like just to me, looking at the 60s and the modern movement, the modern proliferation of MDMA, it's like throw fairy dust in the eyes of the population. And so they're just, they're unaware of, they're unaware of what's happening politically. They're just dazzled by, wow, you know, archetypes or, in genuine spiritual traditions, the mystical experience that comes later, that comes after you've had a real background in, developing your ego. Psychedelic stuff, this non-dual philosophy out there now that people are saying, oh, you know, you got to like ego death, like go beyond your ego. No, you don't. You're not supposed to go beyond your ego. You're supposed to really be your ego and inhabit your ego. That's your vehicle. That's yourself. That's your discipline. That's what you do. That's your conduct in the world. You don't obliterate that with drugs.
You build a relationship with it. And
Yeah.
And then John F. Kennedy, I remember you mentioned on Kyle's podcast, it was fascinating. And then I bought the book, Mary's Mosaic.
Yeah.
Is that the name of the book where he had his experience? And a lot of people like him at the time, it was like everyone was using them. I mean, you had the Grateful Dead and you had Ken Kesey. So there was all these movements happening, like you said, but people like Kennedy had his beautiful experience and then gives his speech. And it's just
That episode, that period of American history, Kennedy turning on, that shows, and then the aftermath, that shows, kind of the best and the worst of what psychedelics do. John Kennedy was a very unusual guy. As we said before, it can really amplify the power of a creative personality. And so Kennedy was turned on to psilocybin by his lover, confidant, Mary Meyer. And it it really accelerated his own spiritual maturational process. And he began to change very quickly after that. Gave this, as you just said, the peace speech, one of the most important speeches ever given by an American president, according to a lot of people, which he wrote himself, delivered it unvetted by his, advisors in the CIA, announced that he was having a secret relationship with Khrushchev. They were going to end the Cold War. They were going to stop nuclear testing. He was going to get out of the Vietnam War. And he was introducing a whole vision of a humanitarian world based on peace, the only rational goal of rational men. And I think that the CIA had no idea whether it was like a backfire. They didn't think psychedelics could do this. And Kennedy was, Kennedy was one in a million. Or you hear Francis Crick, or people will mention LSD has been so useful for all these great inventions. DNA was discovered by Francis Crick. Or, these are the unique people that already had really well-developed personalities and creative gifts. And Kennedy was going to really accelerate returning America to its democratic principles. And they executed him. And right after Kennedy's assassination, so he was killed in November of 1963. In January of 64 is when this so-called British invasion happened. When social engineering, there was a very somber period in 1963. I can kind of remember it. I was, 6-7 years old at the time. And everybody loved Kennedy. I loved that guy. He was from Boston. I was from Boston. He had an accent like my mother. He was this great, dashing, our president. We were the greatest. And then come home from school one day and he's been murdered. Like, what the fuck? Somber, somber mood. What is going on here? Well, then that mood starts to change very dramatically in the beginning of 64. The Beatles are suddenly like, wow, the Beatles, and like this new hairstyle and they're that's all a psychological operation to change the mood and rush in with this whole, you know, that was a coup d'etat that was followed up with these distracting, mood changing, you know, psychedelic drugs, soma. That was what was happening then.
And go into a little bit about your knowledge on Laurel Canyon and that whole weird scenes in the canyon idea as a part of that Beatles movement, as also just some of the more interesting things that were happening at the time where maybe the CIA was doing things to distract and to – they used music as a main form, right?
Yeah, they did.
And they still do. I mean, it's not like this stuff goes away. A lot of people think, oh, that was then and here's now and we're – it's like, why would those – programs dissolve and just disappear? They're just highly more sophisticated and more decentralized.
They're more sophisticated. But, so I, you know, this is not my research, but that fellow Dave McGowan wrote a very important book called, I think it's called Weird Scenes.
Weird Scenes in the Canyon.
In the Canyon, showing the, you know, the frequency of military industrial families and influence on the rock and roll scene of the 60s. And I think he paints the picture with a little too broad a brush because he's making a very important point that, again, that was part of the soma movement, part of the distraction, and pacified people, distracted them. It also inspired people. You know, we'd have to really look at this and take some time. One of the things I like to point out is that the Grateful Dead, for example, there are a lot of curious military, industrial, CIA, Freemason, secret society symbols and people entangled in the genesis of the Grateful Dead. And there was Jerry Garcia, who had military. He was in special ops. He was a genius musician. I think that Jerry Garcia was that Jerry Garcia and Timothy Leary and John Lennon were similar characters in that they became aware that they were being used by a political agenda that they didn't like, and it destroyed them. I mean, Jerry Garcia has said at one point in an interview you can find, it was in an interview he gave to the Marin Independent Journal. He tried to break the band up in the 1970s, and he said, "I just don't want to be part of a CIA project anymore." John Lennon said similar things, you know, that their music was crafted by men behind the scenes, that the world is run by insane people, and, you know, was really going to start to become more vocal about his political orientation, his anti-war movement, meme warfare. His song Mind Games is really very brilliant. And Timothy Leary, the same way. And so Lennon was assassinated, it appears. Jerry just, you know, wanted to play music, just kind of, you know, was a heroin addict for a long time. And Tim was, you know, threatened with, you know, really severe shit. And he just, you know, finally, like Zach, I didn't want to get into conspiracy stuff anymore. His character was assassinated. And he was just, you know, lived out his life as, you know, sort of a stimulating character, but didn't really dig into any of these conspiracies. Left little trails. You know, if I was going to teach a course, we would go through Leary's whole opus, his works, and say, well, look, you know, like what I just said about the British invasion. I may publish this soon. I have I found a Leary interview that's never been published where he gets into this a little bit, you know, like the long history of British intelligence using drugs to control population and how he found out about this and realized he just had no choice but to go along with it. And
it's similar to your story a little bit later. I mean, obviously in the 80s for you, but being so conveniently placed in Gordon Wasson's archives and then meeting Sasha Shulgin and being taught how to make MDMA. It's like in a good-hearted spiritual sense, you had good intentions and then you start to realize this thing later, even after your book. It seems like as I read your book, Entheogens and the Future of Religion, and I could see your perspective then versus now, at least that's what I'm seeing, and how it evolves over time. And that's what I like to help remind myself and others of, is the human component to the whole thing is that there's people, and you know, people are, we're ignorant, and we're always ignorant, and that's what knowledge is and gnosis, and we're seeking to understand more about the nature of the world, and we change over time. You can't hold somebody down into a box and think that they're the same person one time versus another time. And I think that's what's interesting about that movement too, especially when it comes to that weird scenes in the canyon, the Laurel Canyon element. It's like, it's so complex. There was so many musicians, the Jimi Hendrixes and Janis Joplins. And, you know, and then I met Don Howard. He was 72 when I met him. And I got to hear all the cool stories about when he was 18 and he got turned on at the Atlantic Music Festival. And he was just a young kid that was smart, and he was studying ethnobotany and he was trying his best. And individuals doing their best get took off path at certain times, and then they find their path. And I think we always have to have that compassionate mindset by looking at the truth, which is like, hey man, we're all going to make mistakes. And I like how Jamie Wheel says it, let's make better new mistakes and not make the same old mistakes. So let's look at our history and extract what went off the rails in the 60s and 70s, and let's try not to let this thing plunder again. And that's why I actually want to have more conversations with people like yourself and people from both sides and hear different perspectives, because we're all just people trying to figure it out. And anyway, I just wanted to throw that out there to you.
Yeah. I mean, I was alive in those days when LSD first hit, when the psychedelics first hit. I was growing up in northern New Jersey, and you know, the acid rock thing. And I saw what psychedelic drugs did to my high school peers, and it wasn't pretty. And, you know, the music just was kind of discordant. I just couldn't get into it. But there was some, you know, like brilliant music. Like there's a big difference between, you know, Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, and some, you know, the soul heart centered folk rock kind of stuff. Bob Dylan, a lot of Bob Dylan stuff is really, you know, philosophically edifying. And but then there's other, like The Doors, you know, has like, oh, there's a sort of degenerate. So it's a very complicated story, and it needs to be painted with a finer brush. And you know, if you look at the books that I've published so far, my first book, Entheogens and the Future of Religion, is a pretty fairly scholarly collection of writings which advocate the use of psychedelic drugs in history, illuminate the use of psychedelic drugs in the history of religion, and argue for the use of them in modern spiritual practice. And then the second book I did was about Timothy Leary, when I realized, like, you know, Tim was actually a really great guy. And, you know, he's a flawed character, but, you know, like, blame him for stuff is oversimplifying. You're scapegoating him to cover up something that's much more complicated. And then the next book I did was a book that advocated a model of psychedelic drug use that I still affirm. And that's why I'm living in Greece. That's what brought me here to Greece. And that's the mystery school model. That's a model where mystery schools mean, the word mystery comes from the ancient Greek word to be silent. You know, take these drugs. You don't talk about them. They're sacred. They're meant to initiate you into a certain awareness. You do them very infrequently. The great Eleusinian mysteries, people went once in their lives. You weren't allowed to talk about them. Speaking about what happened was, you know, really forbidden. And they were just like, you know, treated sacred. And that's it. They weren't like sold on the street. You didn't have these, you know, profiteers like Doblin, or, you know, they weren't, they were sacred. and they just sort of, your use of them was, private and effective. And that's what, that's similar to how the peyote is used in, you look at indigenous societies, they weren't part of the daily life. They weren't advertising, there's been this tremendous co-option of indigenous practices in the modern use. I see this a lot, like the ayahuasca is used in the 80s and 90s, it was the rave scene. Like every major city throughout the world, there were these warehouses set up and hundreds, thousands of young people would be given MDMA and listening to this mind-numbing music. And now, then there's this, huge wave of ayahuasca. I saw this stuff happening in my own life. In the 1980s, very few people, anthropologists, and serious people investigating indigenous practices knew about ayahuasca. Now it's like every city and town in the country, there's 10 ayahuasca groups going on. People paying hundreds of dollars to these people that call themselves ayahuascaros. There's a total profaning of an indigenous practice, and rampant sexual abuse and real profaning of something sacred. Yeah, yeah.
And people almost just want to check boxes now and seek the next spiritual event or workshop and almost show people their resume of psychedelic passport. Like, hey, I've done Bufo and I've done ayahuasca. And it's almost like it gives them this hierarchy of importance. And it's not true at all. It's like, I've done ayahuasca 55 times, but you're still the same character. And it's like, I know that after the one time that I went down there, Don Howard had that place in the early 90s, and he was one of two places, and there was no marketing. It was all word of mouth. It was done with care. And I waited 7 years to have some experience like that. And when I came back from it, I even told him, I said, I may never do that again. And he said, that's the beautiful approach. It's not something, it's a lifetime of integrating that experience. And now it's like, nope, it's the next bump, and people are going to keep. And I'm trying not to be as judgmental about it, but it's just the truth. I think we in the West, we do that with things. We did it with yoga. And I would actually like to hear your perspective on Indian mysticism and the CIA's involvement with bringing that stuff to the Western culture and how much that took off. Because that was all corrupt too. We saw how the gurus and how many people ended up exploiting their power. And it's still happening today at yoga studios, and it's a mess, man. I tell people, maybe you shouldn't do any of this stuff. Maybe you should just go gently into it and read the history first and try some breath work on your own and start to explore consciousness gently and start to build tools and context before leaping in with some neo shaman that's wearing a big brimmed hat and big beads and he says he's a shaman on Instagram. It's so freaking embarrassing.
Yep. Well, you got it. I mean, there's not much more that we can say about it, but it is kind of the same thing. We saw this wave of Eastern mysticism coming over in the 50s. It was really kind of sped up with psychedelics, all these gurus coming over. And, traditionally yoga was a very esoteric practice designed for older people to prepare their bodies to die and be able to sit in meditation. And suddenly it just became like a fashion statement. And these yoga schools started setting up and then, so like ayahuasca is now the new, instead of, when I was a teenager or in college, like, you got into yoga and you wanted to go to India and find your guru. Well, that's kind of passe. Now you go to Peru or Colombia. And you got these charismatic people, pop up to get you to do this. And it's a lot of that is, again, I don't want to say it's all bad because there are real valuable aspects to practicing yoga and being in shape and pranayama and the esoteric sciences of these traditions, that can be really valuable. I've certainly gotten a lot of benefit from, my study of Eastern religion and meditation. And I've gotten a lot of benefit you know, from my research into ayahuasca. So, but the, you know, what's, you know, when I first went to Peru in the early I started drinking ayahuasca in the late 1980s, you know, and I've had, I don't know, 150 experiences with it. Then I wanted to do this cancer project. It was going down there. It was still like pretty protected and you had to kind of look around. It was 2003. But by 2011, it was like, holy shit, they're like everybody, they're like popping up like Burger Kings all over the place. You fly into the airport in Lima and they got guys holding signs saying, hey, ayahuasca, ayahuasca. You know, so.
It's crazy stuff. Well, Robert, I know your time is valuable and I really enjoy this conversation and I look forward to having more. I can see that we're going to do that someday.
Yeah, let's keep it going.
Is there anything you'd like to share? Like say you were going to die in a week. I like to think like this. I like to always consider I'm going to be dead soon and I like to think from that space. What would you want to share that's like a most important thing, if anything, with the younger generation or with people at large, you know? Because I always say we're going to be dead soon, not in a negative way, but just something to give us the honest truth that, you know, our words matter.
Well, I can just share where I'm coming from now with, altered states and what I see happening. And I'm not really interested in having them anymore. I used to be, you know, to take DMT and I want to explore these worlds beyond my body and beyond myself. And it eventually occurred to me that the real miracle, the real psychedelic thing is to just appreciate who we are and that we're here. Like the miracle of our life is the most psychedelic thing I can imagine. Or, for example, take a deep breath. Take a deep, mindful breath. People like, oh, I'm going to take DMT and I'm going to have a unitive experience. You can have a unitive experience just by taking a breath. When you contemplate that oxygen that's nourishing you is produced by a plant in concert with light from the sun and other stars, like, just think about that for a second. These other worlds beyond the body, we're going to die, man. And there's plenty of time for that. And once you die, what are we going to do? Like, we are in a spirit realm, then you got to rush back into a body? No. Let's be here who we are. Let's enjoy this miracle of life and be human beings. It took us a long time to become human beings. Why do we want to rush out of it and go be something, you know, cosmic? That's coming later. You know, it's like, that's kind of my thing now. And it's funny because I've just moved out here and I'm meeting people and they, you know, oh, you're Robert Fortin, you're a psychedelic expert. You know, like they think I travel around with a, you know, bag full of drugs. And I'm, you know, I'm the psychedelic expert that says people that are taking these drugs, you probably had enough and ought to stop. But for people that, you know, don't have any idea, maybe just have a little bit to just get that realization and then go on with your life and raise your children, act mindfully in terms of politics, don't follow leaders, you know. And that's my thing. I'm much more grounded in who I am. And I'm not interested in rushing out of my state of consciousness.
I hope that beautiful helps. Man, I don't think you could have said it any better. That sounds like a pretty integrated approach after your years of being here. So that was beautiful. I appreciate you. I respect you, and I'm happy to have had this conversation. I look forward to getting to know you more. So.
So you may come out to Greece and at the end of the summer, you know, there's a good chance that I'm going to be going up to the Northern Europe in the later part of the summer. But
cool. Yep. I'll definitely be making a trip to Greece and we will try to coordinate it. And maybe we can even throw on the headset again and do a little deeper dive. Who knows?
Yep. Let me know what you want to do with this and we'll be in touch.
Sounds good.
All right.
Thank you,
Brian.